Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Richard Williams, who is a professor of contemporary visual cultures at the University of Edinburgh, about his book, Why Cities Look the Way They Do. So welcome to the podcast.
Oh, welcome. Well, thank you for the invitation. Lovely to be here.
This is a really interesting book, really wide ranging, very global, both in I think its kind of use of examples, but also in its ambition, really. And I got a sense of that with, I guess, what is the underlying thesis of the book, which is an attempt to kind of reframe how we think about cities. And this comes through really strongly in the idea of we shouldn't think about cities as being designed, but we should think about them through processes. And the place to start with the book is where that kind of idea of thinking about cities and processes came from, and what sort of motivated that that thinking as a way of understanding cities.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really good question. And I think probably the best thing to start with is to say that I'm by no means the first person to do this. I mean, I'm working in a tradition of people who every so often think about cities in this sort of context. So there are people that listeners to the podcast will know about. I mean, for example, there's Melvin Weber in the 1960s. You might know about, who's thinking about cities very much in a kind of network context. Or there's Bernard Rudovsky, also mid 60s. So there are all sorts of people that I can think of. There are lots of people from the 60s in particular. And I think what I wanted to escape from was, or felt that I needed to reassert, was the idea that cities could somehow be designed. And I think partly that was to do with the academic context that I work in. So I'm there, as you know, I'm in the art history department, and we tend to think about design in a broad sense. We think about authorship in quite a traditional sense, whether it's works of art or architecture or design or whatever. So we have that huge tradition to work with. And it just seems that every so often you need to reassert this idea. I have an acute sense of, partly through lived experience, but just partly through the kind of reading that I've done, an acute sense of the need to say this. So every so often, that the fact that we can't design everything, there are limits to design. The authorship is fundamentally distributed and multiple. In a sense, we're all the authors of the cities that we live in. So in a sense, that there's a there are all of those things going on. There's a politics to it as well. I think I've always been drawn to accounts of cities that have emphasized lived experience as much as anything else. So, you know, that's partly, you find a lot of that in mainstream architectural discourse, if you know where to look. But also I've read and done a lot of work on Brazil over the years, and Brazilian architectural and urban discourse, you know, necessarily it has to be about the fact that cities are very hard to design. In that context, the institutions that would allow cities to be designed are weak, civil society is weak, there are all sorts of things going on that are almost impossible to control. So any sort of account of cities in that kind of context has to accept them as being unruly, undesignable, process-orientated.
I mean, before we get into the actual processes that you highlight, the other thing that struck me, you know, you mentioned kind of personal experience a couple of times, was the reflexivity of the book, talking about the potential kind of limits of the analysis. And, you know, you talk about John Urie's tourist gaze there. And this links, I think, as well to the, and it's difficult to do this on a podcast, but, you know, the sort of visual and image-based forms of analysis. And so I'm quite interested to know actually a little bit about where you'd position that sense of how far you can go with focus on process and visual analysis and where there might be kind of limits to what you can do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I was acutely conscious of the limits. And you know, you bring up the idea of the tourist gaze, which is a concept that many of us have used in, you know, in my case, quite a superficial way, but a kind of useful way every so often. I was acutely conscious of the limits of the project. I mean, I felt that in many of the situations that I was describing, I really was no more than a tourist, and the best that I could do was just to accept that and position myself as a tourist and say that you know, is no substitute for being absolutely embedded in a place. But then, of course, you know, what are you going to do? You only have one life. There's only a limited amount of time. So I felt that once I'd positioned myself in that way and accepted the limits of it, then it allowed me to make some transnational, transcultural comparisons. And, you know, ultimately, a lot of the processes that I was describing were and are global processes, and I wanted to be able to say something about those. But yeah, it was a book of limits in all sorts of ways. I mean, but thinking about the tourist position, well, one of the places that I was oddly most conscious of that was Leicester, which is where my children now live and have been for a few years, and it's a city I've got to know quite well. And it's quite an important figure in the book. And I felt that it was a place that was sort of uncannily familiar in some ways, even though I didn't know it until recently. But it was also a place that I was absolutely a tourist, because a lot of the situations that I was trying to describe or trying to encounter were to do with populations whose you know, origins and economic and cultural links with the Indian subcontinent, and you know, I was acutely aware of how far I could engage with that, but I was also curious about it, and I wanted to try and say something about it. So yes, limits limits were very important, and it's a short book too. You know, it's only 70,000-80,000 words or so.
I mean, you mentioned the kind of global nature of many of the processes that you try and analyze in the book. And I mean, the really obvious one is transnational flows of capital. You pick, I mean, throughout the book, there are a range of examples, and, you know, we'll only touch on a few of them. But I think thinking about some of the architecture of the City of London juxtaposed with, you know, the kind of moment of a contemporary concern with inequalities was a really good way of starting to think about how processes shape cities. And I wonder, maybe we could pick out some of the discussions of, you know, people like Piketty, and then how these in some ways kind of fascinating architectural almost event style buildings have taken place in London, but also how, you know, the particular sort of grotesque nature of how much a square foot is worth in the upper regions of an institution determine the shape of both buildings and cities.
Yeah, I was fascinated by money. I mean, I have a kind of amateur knowledge of economics. I mean, in another life, I think I'd like to have been an economist. so I'm a kind of self-taught person in that regard. But I'm fascinated by it because in the context I was writing about, which was cities that basically self-identify as global, money was in so many ways the key driver for things. And it seemed to be the thing that was making the biggest impact on the skylines of cities. So, you know, if the main question of the book is why cities look the way they do, you know, you think about the transformations of say London, and the skyline has been completely transformed by the movement of a certain kind of free-flowing capital in the last decade, you know, certainly since the financial crisis. So I was fascinated by those things. I think trying to get a grip on how it might be different or how it has been different in the recent past. Piketty was an interesting read, and I can't claim to be any kind of expert on that, but I did read Capital and got quite a lot out of it. And in particular, I got the idea this formulation, R is greater than G. In other words, accumulated wealth, or the return on accumulated wealth, is greater than economic growth. And that's a very suggestive formulation in the book. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought it explained something about the skyline of global cities, where, you know, there was, say, you know, reasonable economic growth, but nothing spectacular. And yet the outward form of those cities was becoming more and more spectacular, and the amount of capital involved in producing that spectacle was really huge. You know, and one place that I started thinking about this, I suppose, was somewhere that didn't particularly make it into the book, but it was Manchester, which was, you know, a city that you know well enough. I know extremely well, but there was something that happened, I suppose, in the, I don't know, it must have been about 2005-06, where suddenly it became possible to do really big buildings. And it was really a phenomenon that had nothing to do with the size of the city or even the size of the economy particularly, but it had everything to do with confidence and the sudden ability to attract global capital. So when I left that city, I did a PhD there, when I left it, a big building was, I don't know, 50, 60,000 square feet. And then not very long after that, a big building was basically 10 or maybe 15 times the size. So the imagination of what was big had changed enormously, and, you know, really not explained by the size of the economy. You know, you weren't looking at an economy that had got 15 times bigger. That was really my starting point. And so many of the examples that I looked at are examples of buildings that are just, you know, huge in relation to the size of the economy in which they sit. And I was particularly interested, and this is a sort of related, slightly different point, particularly interested in the growth of buildings which seem to be almost entirely for investment. One of those, the most spectacular one, was this pencil thin, extraordinary tower in Manhattan, 832 Park Avenue, so right in the middle of Midtown, by an Uruguayan architect called Rafael Vignoli, who's done a lot of work in Britain, including the notorious walkie-talkie building. But the Manhattan building, this 832 Park Avenue, is a building that's it's incredibly tall. And I forget how many stories, 70 stories, something of that order. It is all residential. The apartments, you know, start at 10 million, something like that, go up to as much as you want to pay. But even the developers seem to think that it would never be occupied, or practically never be occupied. So this extraordinary piece of real estate, you know, major thing on the skyline, it didn't really matter whether there were people living there. As long as people owned it, it was fine. And, you know that phenomenon in London pretty well. There's famously or notoriously, there's lots of apartment buildings that have been put up in the last 10, 15 years or so, which, you know, appear not to be occupied. They're kind of ghost cities. But it doesn't seem to matter, because as long as they're owned, they're doing the job. So they're basically safety deposit boxes. And that phenomenon, many people have written about it, but I wanted to try and summarize it and put it in a useful form. It seems to be one of the most distinctive things that has happened in cities in the last decade or so.
I mean, the other thing bound up with money is power. And, it's quite early on in the book, you kind of set out money and power as critical. And to an extent, this is almost sort of territory that we'd expect a discussion of the contemporary city to be comfortable with. Mm. But more, I suppose, kind of provocative and interesting is the idea that sexuality and to a kind of related extent, gender would have a kind of key role as one of the processes of a city. And I guess this picks up on some of your earlier work in a previous book. And I was trying to think about the best way to formulate a question. What could you tell me about sex in the city? Because phrase. But, there is something really fascinating, I think, in terms of your analysis of how sexuality shapes, districts in cities, for example.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I am fascinated by this. there was, I tried to explore this about, was it five, six years ago. There's a book called Sex and Buildings, which got quite widely read. And it's a very interesting topic. It's partly because it's one of those peculiar transformations that's happened in plain sight. So I often find I'm writing about things that I've experienced or seen transform before my eyes. And it just seemed very clear that cities, as well as becoming very conscious of the way that they look, a lot of the way that they look has been bound up with new kinds of sexual economy. Now, I think, when I first started to think about cities, and I hadn't really thought about this at all, and I think the only way that I could think about sex in relation to cities was in terms of the sex industry, industries, prostitution, or whatever. And I knew nothing about that, and I still don't. But I got interested in the way that sex and sexuality might be mainstream determinants of the way that cities look. And very, very simply, that arose, that interest, it arose through living, when I was doing a PhD, this is a long time ago, but doing that at a moment when Manchester's gay village was really starting to acquire a presence, and it was being talked about, and it was something that seemed to be very attractive, and it seemed to be producing a lot of property development as well. So that was my my experience of it. I mean, I was very much on the edge of it, as a straight man with a lot of gay friends. I was sort of hanging around there and sort of getting introduced to a world which I knew very little about until that point. But it was kind of fascinating, and it was from all sorts of perspectives, but particularly it was fascinating because it seemed to be informing the way that cities might look, reproduce themselves visually. So that was my starting point for it. And then I think what I tried to do in the book is reiterate some of that and explore some things that have happened more recently. But it's definitely had an effect on certain kinds of development, on the attractiveness or otherwise of urban living. All kinds of stuff. The modeling of different kinds of ways of living that might not be to do with the nuclear family. I don't know. There's all sorts of things that might go in it. And I feel that there are, it makes sense to talk about a sexual economy as well. And I think one of the things that I mentioned briefly, but it's the idea that even when these economies go online, when you've got dating apps and Tinder and Grindr or whatever, that a lot of those are orientated or fixated around cities. If you sign up to any of these things, you have to say where you are, and it's quite clear that sexual economies in cities are bigger and more powerful, more attractive than sexual economies elsewhere. Those things are interesting. So, I whatever happens over the next few years, I think it's quite clear that it's going to be a powerful determinant. But interested in it as a, in terms of media representation as well, how important sitcoms were in creating that idea or making that idea attractive.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, the other really obvious example of this is the other side of the world, and the Castro District in San Francisco, which is extremely different from central Manchester in lots of different ways. And actually, almost the kind of the most interesting juxtaposition isn't actually between those two places, but actually it's between this chapter and the next, and the relationship between what is seen to be this kind of fascinating kind of liberal hippie influenced kind of gay utopian part of the West Coast, and then the thing that you kind of develop as quite a kind of dull architecture of the creative industries of bungalows and server farms. And I found that relationship really, really interesting, particularly in the context when we're meant to think of creative industries as being full of, reclaimed aerodromes and, led regeneration and stuff like this. But actually what we're talking about is, multi-occupant bungalows and quite boring architectural spectacles.
Yeah, I mean, you're referring to Silicon Valley, really. I got very interested in Silicon Valley, and at some point, maybe I'll do a much more extended project on it. But yeah, the way it looks is very interesting in terms of its self-effacing qualities. I mean, at the moment, it does seem to be going through something of a revolution where Facebook and Google and Apple have all been investing in architecture and have started to make themselves more spectacular. But basically, the landscape of Silicon Valley is incredibly low-key and reclusive almost. But it has these bizarre characteristics. It's the... money is incredibly important. The cost of real estate there is ludicrous. I mean, it has become absolutely ludicrous. It's one of the most expensive places on earth. And yet to look at it, it is very bland and self-effacing and, you know, ordinary. Extremely odd. I have really enjoyed thinking of sitcoms, actually. Sitcom called Silicon Valley. I think beautifully done. And it's one of the things that has been really enjoyable about it has been the way that it depicts that environment. And but I particularly like this bungalow turned incubator space where you have all of these dudes all sharing this space that was designed for a single family, traditional family, and they've turned it into the complete opposite. I think it's so fascinating. I think that the whole world of work has undergone some of the most severe changes, and you know, that's informed the way that cities look more than anything.
Yeah, and that again comes through in this creative industries focus towards the very end of the book, the way that on the one hand we've got the reclaiming of spaces for work and productive activity, but also the reclaiming of spaces for it's not really leisure, is it, as much as there's the kind of exhibition and display of artistic and cultural goods as much as it is a kind of leisure and a sort of you engage a bit with Frankfurt School and these kind of things.
I got very interested in the informal spaces of work. I mean, one of the starting points of the book was, actually a few years ago, I was wondering whether it'd be possible to start with the cafe as an example, and the way that the cafe and people sitting in, young people sitting in cafes coding, and whether you could work outwards from that and what it would say about the world of work and sex and cities and all of those sorts of things. So I was very, very interested in this rather performative thing that has happened with cafes and work and leisure and hooking up, all sort of blurring into each other. And I think it's been quite corrosive in some ways. I'm not sure I like it at all, but it's been a very distinctive thing that's happened. I mean, who knows? But I mean, right now, of course, none of it's happening. So, who knows what the future of that is? But it's been very distinctive, that kind of process and transformation. Thinking about how cities can't be designed at a certain level. I mean, nobody could really have predicted just how much coffee drinking is going to be going on, and how much that would define the look of cities at street level.
I mean, it's really interesting because the book has also got an analysis of how cities, collapse and get ruined by war. But in some ways, what we're dealing with now is a similar kind of, moment of collapse, except, the infrastructure is still there, is, almost untouched, apart from the fact that we're likely to see, precisely these important spaces of work, the cafe, not, bringing the shutters up once people start to kind of reemerge. That's probably, a kind of moment to speculate on what the book offers us right now. Do you think we're going to see this process, whether we'd call it, the coronavirus process or, lockdown as a process? What do you think that means for the contemporary city?
God, I mean, it's this moment is just extraordinary. It has made me rethink or start to rethink pretty much everything I've been teaching in the last 15 years. And, clearly it turns the thesis of the book on its head, or at least it turns the book into history almost immediately. I think just to say something about that, I mean, the almost everything that I describe as process, involves some kind of sociability. You know, so much of the way that money circulates and sexual economies work and work has been working in recent years has been to do with a very exaggerated kind of sociability and also density. You know, I mean, that was the thing that, being the age that I am, I mean, I have become very conscious of just how much denser cities have become and how, you know, density has become a value and sociability has become a very, very important value. I mean, those things have been so powerful. You know, they run all the way through any kind of process that you want to talk about, you know, culture as well is a key thing. So we're in a situation where basically we can't be social. And it just turns that whole concept of the city right on its head altogether. So the question is, you know, is this a pause? Is this a temporary moment where a few things stop for a bit and then we revert back to how things have been in the last 20 years? Or is it a moment where things fundamentally change again? I have to say, I wonder if it's the latter. I think we had this long period of the reassertion of the dense city, and you know, there's been almost like a Victorianization of cities in the most developed and richest parts of the world, and of course the emptying out of cities in the the middle of the 20th century, and to an extent before that, the development of the New Town movement, things like that. So many of those emptying processes were to do with the fear of disease. You know? If we become afraid of disease again, if sociability becomes something that needs to be measured, you know, controlled, then we're going to be into a very different realm, and different kinds of cities will, I would have thought, quite soon start to become attractive. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be, low density suburbs or whatever. But I think we might be seeing different kinds of ideas of cities becoming more attractive. You know, new towns. I can see the new towns starting to become. Coming back into favour again. I don't know. It depends very much how long it goes on, isn't it? You know, I mean, at the moment we're just a month into it, but you know, 3 months, people's behaviour might start to change.
In terms of what next for you, I mean, it sounds as if there's a really rich kind of, you know, social distancing, lockdown, Corona book to be written, precisely with this kind of process based analysis, or. Mm. Thinking in terms of something very, very different?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I'm finishing up a book on the architectural critic and historian Rainer Banham. And I mean, the point of that is really to try and bring Banham to a slightly wider audience. I mean, he was a big deal in the 60s and 70s, but basically in the architectural world. But I think a lot of what he was saying and speculating about is very transferable, and he would have been absolutely fascinated by this moment. You know, he was somebody who was always thinking about the future. I mean, is it slightly related to him? I think one question, and which may produce a bigger project, but a question that really interests me is about mobility. And so one thing that is definitely happening, if I can actually get there, is a stay in Brazil. So I'm going to spend, in theory, next year, three months in Sao Paulo, which is a city I really love to visit. And the reason for going there is that they have had for some years a project that has closed down the central motorway that circles around the central part of the city, the core, the historic core. And this motorway is called the Minhocão, or the big worm, great word. And at night they close it down, and it becomes this impromptu park. And it, you know, all human life is there. It's just fascinating. And I've spent enough time there to know it's a really good good thing to work on. But what I'm thinking of working on, basically in a larger scale context, is what happens to mobility, really. You know, when if we've lived through a period of where we expect a huge amount of mobility, but what if things don't do that? You know, what if, like them in your car at night, we start to slow things down, if we start to reinvent the infrastructure and mobility that we've got, what if we can't fly everywhere? I mean, I don't know. Not quite sure where this is going exactly, but Sao Paulo is far from alone, and there are many cities that have done things like this, and there's a sense in which we've got this infrastructure that's been all about people moving about at high speed, freely, all of that. You know, what if we have to rethink that? And you know, the obvious connections now with the coronavirus situation.